For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as in a cave. We invite you now to join us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle, Timothy O'Donnell, and Joseph Tomasian. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mark Tuttle and Joseph Tomasian. Gentlemen, in the news, the outgoing governor of Oregon has commuted the death sentence for 17 convicted felons, her argument being that, in her opinion, the death penalty is immoral. Now, this is in the same state in which euthanasia has become a growing accepted fact, if almost not an industry. Yeah. How do we justify this? Or can we?
Well, I mean, I guess the bottom line question, is there a contradiction there? So, you know, here in the Catholic Cave, we try to take headlines like that. We try to take, you know, what's in the newspaper, what's in the news, and get below the surface a little bit. Look not so much at the particulars of a case like that, but look at the principles, look at the underlying philosophical ideas that are going on. And that one, there's a lot. There is a lot there to kind of look at and analyze.
There's so much to unpack in this one.
Right.
I mean, when you look at the morality or lack thereof of an action, first of all, for the head of a state, a governor, to say that she's going to overturn legal precedent because she personally finds things to be immoral, is that a slippery slope to allow governors of other states to enact their own sort of leaning on actions that the state requires based upon an emotion? You know, well, perhaps, you know, one state wants to do X because, you know, their governor thinks that it is moral or whatnot. And what happens if I don't agree with that arbitrary value of morality and immorality?
Yeah, and that's a perennial question in the United States, because obviously the art of politics, you go back to Plato, you go back to where the discussion around politics sort of began. And it's an extension of ethics. In the Greek mind, you know, ethics is how you rule your household, right? So ethics is the rule of private life.
That's right.
Politics is the rule of public life. So, you know, there's a connection there between ethics, morality, etc., and politics. On the other hand, we live in a pluralistic society, and the argument's out there, and you know, I hear it in the pro-life movement all the time. We live in a pluralistic society, and this is the kicker here. Morality is an extension of religion. So your moral views come from your religious views. Therefore, in a pluralistic society, it's not right for one group to impose their morality on another group through the law. So, you know, that would be sort of the question there. You know, I don't know how a person can act and it not be ethical. I mean, it not be within the realm of ethics and morality. I mean, you're pretty much most of the things you do are based off of some sense of what is the right thing to do.
Yeah. And I sort of lament the idea that ethics are sort of denigrated into a person's personal worldview based upon, you know, their faith, their religion. I understand how we got there. But the idea of ethics and, you know, oikonomia, how one maintains one's household, is so arbitrary at this point. And to say that the, you know, one thing is good for one person but bad for another person, I think that fundamentally is why there's this great political divide in our country, because we do have a plurality of thought where We try to value others' opinions based upon their particular worldviews. But when two worldviews violate the principle of non-contradiction, and how do you move forward with something like that and end up in a case where a state can say that, you know, killing a person is wrong, but killing yourself is acceptable?
Right. And the fallacy there, though, I think is something that you said going back, and that is that, you know, what's right for me is right for me, what's right for you is what's right for you, and those two may be on complete opposite ends of the pole. You know, there is a universal morality.
And
I think the coupling of moral and ethical codes to religion, and by religion meaning, you know, honestly, which theistic sect you're going to follow, because you know, and I think that's an interesting discussion too, because you, once again, going back to the Greeks, you had the monotheistic world, you had, you know, the Judeo-Christian understanding of one God,
which was a minority in that time,
but nonetheless, in their mind, when they said there is one God, what they meant is that there is a God.
Right.
And so the consideration there is, if you're a polytheist, you really don't believe in God at all.
Right.
And throughout, you know, not ancient Greek society, but, you know, moving into the Roman society and to the Middle Ages, to be a polytheist was to be an atheist. And I think that distinction is actually still true. I think, you know, those that claim, well, you know, there's a plurality of gods, what they're really saying when they get down to it is there's a plurality of moral codes.
Right.
Each, you know, each country, each city, each place, or each household, it's up to them to decide what's right and wrong. And when you say it's up to them to decide, ultimately you're saying there's no higher power than mankind
to
make these decisions. So functional polytheism and atheism are pretty much the same thing.
Right.
And I think that's where we come into problems, is because we do sit there and say, okay, in America, we've got this, you know, freedom of church and state leads us to a situation where we can't assert kind of the obvious that there is one God, you know, that there is one set of moral standards that applies to everybody. We've gotten to a point where we really can't say that publicly.
Well, lest we should fall into, you know, the category of saying that, you know, we're trying to impose our religion on somebody else, I want to come back to the idea that an ethical code of behavior exists independently of any sort of faith, denomination, or religious context. And in doing so, I think it's important that that we do fully identify the reality that behavior is something that precedes the Judeo-Christian religions.
Right. Yeah. The relationship between religion and morality, I think, is something that really does need to get explored here, because, yeah, religion, I think I'm safe in saying this, and maybe this is a topic, religion is descriptive.
Right.
Where morality is prescriptive,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So morality is really, when you look at ethics, the moral code is what you ought to do. The Ten Commandments simply describe that. But the fact that it is wrong to murder pre-exists the Ten Commandments,
right?
You know, I mean, that applied to Noah, that applied to Adam and Eve. I mean, you know, that morality, you know, when Cain killed Abel, Cain knew he was doing something wrong, and he didn't have a religion or Ten Commandments to tell him such.
If we sort of take a meta look at the Ten Commandments themselves, it's not something that, you know, we have our scriptural traditions, and we have our biblical stories of, you know, Moses being on the mountain and the burning bush and God presenting these tablets to Moses, and that God, you know, wrote these things on the tablets, and that's hagiographical. God doesn't have a hand, you know, so it's he's not going to particularly write the words of the Ten Commandments. But instead, I want to take a step back and point to the Ten Commandments being, I'd say, a prescriptive development, a written down context of how natural law itself has formed throughout the ages prior to, you know, the Semitic clans in the Near East. You know, the peoples of that region had natural, like everybody in the world has natural law, but to write them down and say, you know, this is what's natural to mankind in being in relationship with God, and one of those is don't murder.
Right. But I think the story of Moses and the way the Ten Commandments got handed down to him in the Bible does make that moral code for Judaism and the claims that are around that moral code unique for that area.
I don't know that it's unique for the area, because if you go to the Pygmies of, you know, the Polynesia, they know that murder is bad, but their definition may differ slightly. They know that, you know, stealing is wrong and you shouldn't take somebody else's wife. You know, these things are natural to the human heart.
They're natural to the human heart, but the claim there, I think, for the pygmy is that this is what our God told us.
Right.
So this is what we have been told by our particular God, but it doesn't apply to everybody.
Right.
It could be because there's multiple gods, right? So what's good and right for the pygmies, we've been told for our community, and this is born out of experience, right? This isn't something kind of coming, it isn't literally coming from a God. It's born out of experience of their community, but murder is something that we can't tolerate within our community.
Sure.
We've learned this over time, but the claim is that's for us. It may actually be different for other people, but here murder is wrong, and that happens to be universal, because to have a functioning community based on human nature, it doesn't work to allow murder in your community. But the claim once again is, you know, that's what works for our community. It may not be the same for everybody. With Moses, you have this shroud of ignorance that he's veiled in when the Ten Commandments are revealed to him. And so he goes up the mountain, it's revealed to him and him alone, and he's not allowed to see the face of God. And that ignorance is a sign of universality, right? That these are not just the laws for the Jews. These are the laws for all people.
Well, I think we should, you know, explore that and the archetype it presents when we get back from the break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
A dash of joy, a hint of hope, a lot of love. Mixed thoroughly with deep faith, it's our recipe for a life well lived. Served fresh, daily. Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Joseph Tomasian. And we started our show talking about the governor of Oregon. She recently gave clemency to 17 convicted death row inmates. And, you know, my understanding is in Oregon, there's been a moratorium on the death penalty for over a decade now.
Yeah, 2011.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of a backstory to this too, beyond just the morality of it. But that's what she said. You know, when she did this, she said this was based because she thinks that the death penalty is immoral. And I think that's a question we probably eventually ought to get to. Is she right about that? But I find even assertion that my motive is because this is immoral and this is my own personal belief, therefore I can do it as a governor, to be an interesting claim, especially coming from a place like Oregon, which is sort of known, well, you know, they've got legalized euthanasia.
I think it's very progressive.
Exactly. Yeah. And it is known as a place where one is not to impose their morality on other people.
Precisely.
Particularly the governor. And you know, in that, I think that's an interesting question, too. Is there a difference between an individual saying, look, what is right is universally right. The way I do things is the way everybody ought to do things, and trying to convince other people of that. Or somebody who is in charge of the government, in charge of, you know, as a governor, you're really able to call up the National Guard. I guess that's your recourse to arms is being able to use National Guard units, etc. But nonetheless, she has violent means behind her to enforce her opinions.
Well, so I don't know that the role of any head of state is to be an autocrat, which granting clemency based upon her view of morality or immorality is autocratic. You know, she by herself had made that decision. The role of governor is to enforce the laws of the state, to ensure peace, and to develop commerce within the jurisdiction that they oversee. So, regardless of whether I do agree that the death penalty is fundamentally immoral, and this is why the idea of taking, so in what I'm doing is simply echoing Francis's words. The idea of taking away somebody's life as a means of justice, what that does is it also takes away the possibility of their conversion. It takes away their possibility of entering into a deeper relationship with God, which is at least from a philosophical perspective, it violates final causality. The telos of that individual is to be with God, to achieve the good, to be the good, right? And if you take that possibility away, it's a violation. And of course, on the other side, you can say, well, they've already violated that reality for somebody else by doing the heinous actions they did that got them onto death row to begin with. But the purpose of the death penalty is supposed to be to discourage others from, you know, violent actions.
In part. I mean,
legally, that's what we say. We say we're going to kill this person because when we do that, it's justice for the people who are violated, but also it serves as a deterrent for others to not do the thing, which we know statistically has absolutely zero effect on other people's behavior.
Right, right. Practically speaking.
Because I'm going to get away with it.
And I think that's I think there's another sort of underlying philosophical premise there. I think this is really what divides liberals and conservatives politically. And that is, you know, when we look at things like the death penalty, are we going to look at the statistics? Are we going to look at the way it actually plays out? Are we going to look sort of at the practical implications of it? And look at this empirically, which I think that's kind of more of a conservative, that's more of a conservative lens of looking at it.
I don't think either party actually do that. They just do whatever their constituents want them to do.
You know, dividing conservative and liberal versus Republican and Democrat, because I agree. I mean, you know, when you look at the parties, you've got a lot of mixture there.
Yeah.
But if you look at a conservative philosophy versus a liberal philosophy approaches things much
classically more liberal.
Well, and I think even currently progressive liberal too. They approach things from a much more rationalistic, top down, ideological perspective. So in other words, what a government ought to do is what rationally always in all circumstances ought to prevail, where the empiricist basically says, look, no, we live in communities. Those communities have experiences. From those experiences, we have made laws, and we do not have some sort of top-down view of human nature that's well enough established to kind of override what has worked or what hasn't worked over the centuries. And I think the death penalty, looking at it from both those lenses, fails. Right. I mean, and I think from a conservative standpoint, you bring up the, it doesn't act as a deterrent. We know this statistically. We know this. It's not like murder has declined the more we've had executions in this country. That's quite the opposite. It seems like there's other factors that lead people to commit acts of murder and other things,
right.
Not necessarily a lack of deterrence. So justice too. You know, that justice being accomplished by executing a criminal. We have family after family after family. First off, they're against it, and a lot of families will say, no, I feel like the crime was compounded because now we've added a second death on top of what was prior to that, just one death.
Look, Mark, all death is tragic.
Right.
Every single death is tragic. And when we look at the morality of an action, you know, I think Catholic social teaching indicates that there are three different components we have to look at. There's the action itself, there's the intention, there's the circumstance. So let's say that you have some random guy that goes into a house, you know, he breaks and enters. That's wrong. He does heinous acts before he kills the family. Okay, those are wrong subsequently. The intention was to get something he wanted. So this is an act of greed, which is wrong. And the circumstances, the whole family was there. They saw what happened before they were killed. The whole situation is just evil itself. Okay. So you can think about it in those terms. Okay. But let's look at it from an extenuating circumstance. The person who did it was on drugs, okay, which, you know, addiction may be, it's considered a disease today, perhaps there's extenuating circumstance. I mean, there are just 100 different things that we could come at this from a position of how is the individual's culpability lessened, and I'm not the one to answer that question, but I do think it needs to be asked.
Right.
Okay, and so when you move forward and you say, here is justice going to be met out, he's arrested, he's taken to court, he's got to get a special prosecutor who is vetted to do death penalty prosecutions, you know. So even our state, there's only a handful of prosecutors that can prosecute for the death penalty, and defense attorneys who can defend against the death penalty. So I mean, these are highly specialized functional things that we have. And then for a state to say, yep, okay, you met our requirements for this, off you go to death row, and you're going to have to wait, you know, 20 years or so until we can figure this out. But during that time, 20 years, think about who you were 20 years ago. And I have this conversation with my wife. You know, when I think back 20 years, that's like 6 Josephs ago, because I have reinvented myself constantly, keep trying to better myself, moving forward, that I'm not even the same person I was functionally 20 years ago. So you have somebody on death row who's been going through the procedure. And, you know, let's say worst case scenario, they really are a dirtbag. Okay. The purpose of the death penalty is supposed to be to give justice. But if death is always tragic, and we do believe that, how is this giving justice to the community?
Right, right. There's a lot to go back to in your comments right there. But one of the big things that stands out is the way a person changes, right? So a person changes throughout time, but they change it throughout time because of the community they're in, right? You're not a different Joseph just simply because you willed to become a different Joseph. You're a different Joseph because of the experiences you've had. A lot of those are experiences that you've created for yourself, but a lot of those are experiences that have happened because of the community you live in, the other people you're around, the experiences you've had in dealing with other people. So when you put somebody in a prison environment and the changes that take place within that person, they're not in control of their own decisions even at that point. So, the changes and whether rehabilitation takes place or whether it doesn't, et cetera, it doesn't, I don't know.
I think that's fundamentally a flaw on our prison system then. Are we not offering the opportunity to rehabilitate, to reconcile? Are we not doing our part? But that's completely different. Show.
But I don't know, but I do think it plays in, because I think if you're talking about the death penalty, yes, justice is a huge component of it, but it's not the only component of it. I think the fundamental reason for the death penalty is to protect the community and to remove bad apples and other actors that are going to continue to pollute the community, but also, physically threaten the community. I think removing them is part of what the death penalty is there. And you go back to John Paul II's arguments against it. He said, look, we can accomplish those without resorting to the death penalty. Precisely. Now. And so his reasons, though, go back to that protective idea behind the death penalty, not necessarily the restorative justice or the idea of finding justice in it.
And before we head to the break, I also want to, if we're talking about this, there's DNA science evidence is lacking grossly across our country. We have people maintaining their absolute innocence, defense, the families, people on the outside. Yep, that's not the person, but prosecution gets the case. So without getting too far in the weeds here, our crime scene investigation is weak. Even though we have these blood spatter detectives and experts, well, that's something you can earn in 45 hours of online training that has very little scientific validity. Our DNA evidence is still in the a nascent phase. It's underdeveloped. It's we simply can't have the science that we would like to have in those arenas. So how many people, innocent lives, have we taken in the death penalty based upon the person being in the wrong place at the wrong time, or dare I say, even race?
And yet, as Catholics, there's a huge but that needs to get thrown in there. And so we've got to take a break. We'll take a break here on the Catholic Cave. But when we come back, let's discuss that large sort of hanging but that's hanging over this discussion. We'll be right back here on the Catholic Cave.
Do you sometimes think that nobody prays for you? Does it seem like your concerns and worries aren't shared by anybody else? If so, then put that away. We here at Catholic Radio Indy pray for you, our listeners, every single day. If you have a special prayer request, go to www.catholicradioindy.org and let us know. We lift up our listeners' prayers each morning. It's how we start our workday. Let us pray for you, and may God bless you abundantly.
The first radio station signed on back in the 1930s. And wow, people could get news without having to wait for the next day's newspaper and hear great entertainment right in their living rooms. But then in the late 40s, television came along. And since it could add visual content, well, that would probably kill off radio. But it didn't. In the 70s, satellite radio, 8-track tapes and cassettes, and the Walkman came along. Surely one of these would kill off radio. But they didn't. Now there's streaming on computers, podcasts, Alexa, and smartphones that put the world at your fingertips. And you know what? Radio is still here. In fact, a recent survey of people aged 18 and up showed that on a monthly basis, radio reached more people than television, including time-shifted TV. And for audio programming, more people than smartphones, PC, Alexa, or tablets. When you support Catholic Radio Indy, you're supporting a powerful tool that has the potential to reach over 1 million people every day with the message of salvation. If you're one of our donors, thank you very much. If you haven't joined our family of donors yet, today would be a good day to do that. Just go to CatholicRadioIndy.org and click on the donate button. That's CatholicRadioIndy.org. And thank you for your support.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. We are unpacking
so much
because once again, you know, the way the Catholic Cave ideally works, and we've gotten away from it a little bit, but the way it ideally works is we look at the real world, we look for a particular instance, but we look for those universals, we look for those concepts and ideas and things that happen, and we just so happened to come across a news story that had. It was a particular that seemed to pack just about every universal within it.
It's all in there, Mark.
So, the governor of Oregon has granted clemency to 17 death row inmates. And in the course of this, she basically said, well, the reason why is because I find the death penalty immoral. So in that, there's just a huge amount to talk about. And we were just talking about the biggest question there. Is she right? Is the death penalty immoral? And, we have writings of John Paul II that have condemned the death penalty. We have...
And the continuity of Francis.
And we have Pope Francis that has continued that. But there's a pushback against it.
By Catholics.
And the argument is, but you can say that the death penalty is immoral, but the church has condoned the death penalty much longer than it has condemned it. The church has participated in some ways. I mean, depending on how you look at it, in some ways, in executions in the past. So is the church here really, are they changing their moral teachings? Because the Pope, supposedly the Pope can't do that, right? The Pope can't change what's moral and immoral based on what he says. That's kind of going above and beyond the office of the papacy. But on the flip side, you know, if it's immoral now, how can we say that it was moral back then? And I think that's a worthy argument.
And I think we really need to dig into this because for the common Catholic, you know, or for the common non-Catholic, anytime there's an argument against, and I'm using air quotes here, the church, historically speaking, the church is this dark, powerful entity that existed in the ether, you know, pulling the strings of kingdoms and countries and wars and everything in the past. And so the church is the victimizer. The church is the man in the dark who's basically George Soros, right? The church and George Soros, they're the same person. All right? They exist infinitely throughout time, causing, you know, malicious deeds. The church, fought against science and development and women and all this utter crap.
Right.
Can I say crap? I said it. I'm going to say crap. Okay. So the idea of the church being this unified, powerful entity that has existed throughout all time is just nonsense, Mark.
Right. And I think it goes back to the fundamental recognition that Catholicism is a monotheistic religion. And when we talk about that distinction between polytheism and monotheism, that when you say there is one God, and for us, we say there's one God, but three persons. But when you say there's one God, what you're saying is there is one set of rules that are set not by human beings, but by the creator of human beings, the creator of the universe. And those rules then are understood, they're studied, they're revealed, but we come to know them in and through religious experience, but the religion is not God.
Right.
And I think that's an important piece to get out on the table when you're talking about something like the death penalty, where our understanding of it has changed over the centuries.
Right.
So
right.
what we previously saw as something that was necessary, was good, etc. Our experience has borne out that that's not the case. And there's nothing that violates Catholic principle to say that laws over time develop based on experience.
Sure. Yeah. Not only that, but laws were also enforced, not by the church, but based upon the local people who were in charge. And please understand that, it's... you know, up until what, the mid 1800s, the crown and the cross were deeply one, and so for nobles and kings and queens and governments to act on behalf of the church, you know, they did so with the authority of the church, and so it's not the church, it's those who were in power, you know, the nobles. It was the nobles.
Right. And I think it's very important to point out about Catholicism, we've never had a time in our history where the nobles and the bishops have been the same person.
Not exactly accurate. I mean, we have lots of popes who were counts and dukes.
But once again, the distinction between the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, and the papacy,
yeah,
that's a fundamental distinction that characterizes Western Christianity. And I think in our favor that we have always had a separation of the power of the state and the spiritual power of the church, and that those two have always been wielded at least somewhat separately from each other. Now, they've worked in concert.
In theory, we have that.
They've worked in concert with each other very, very well.
But historically, we've had Habsburgs and Medicis who are calling the shots in the kingdoms and in Rome. So the point I'm trying to make is, our history is fraught with fundamentally flawed human beings who have not always made decisions on the interest of Roman Catholicism, but on the interest of temporal power. And so when that happens, it's confusing. But getting back to our segment here, when we distinguish morality of action based upon authority and the law of the land, it has to come back to, is the action itself moral or immoral? And I think that's where we're having this huge debate. It's because killing somebody is fundamentally immoral, doesn't matter. Regardless, intentionally taking somebody else's life is wrong. Period. But as a means of justice, as rehabilitative, is it still functionally useful in our society? Should we still follow through with this from a Roman Catholic perspective?
Right. And the popes have spoken fairly clearly. I mean, Pope Francis has been very clear that no, there is no room in the modern world for the death penalty. But once again, you go back to the question, does that mean that the church was cooperating with, encouraging, teaching that which was immoral in the past to be moral? Was the church wrong about the death penalty in the past?
So I think the teaching has always been, don't kill.
Right,
but the action hasn't always been the same.
Right, and the church does not completely say any war in all war. We're not pacifists, right?
We
don't say all warfare.
We have the just war theory.
Right, exactly. So you know, the church has always sort of said, to protect life, sometimes it's necessary to kill other people, to protect life, and the protection of the community is an extension of that.
Right.
And so in the past, the church has said, you know, look, no, to protect the community, the death penalty is listed. And then John Paul II has subsequently said, you know, look, all of those reasons that were there for protecting the community, they're no longer in place in the modern world. And in the modern world, we have developed to such an extent that there is no way that the death penalty is adding protection to the community beyond what a life term in prison would protect the community. And so, right, you know, it comes down to the argument that the death penalty really no longer works. And I think that is a much stronger argument than the death penalty has always and is just fundamentally immoral top
sure,
down.
Sure.
I think it does get back to the question of morality, right? We understand morality as, I would say, a theoretical science, right? So we understand morality and ethics as something you can study, you can look at different cases, and from that you can come up with universal principles, and those universal principles will apply at all places, all times, in every circumstance. And then that's morality. That's what we look at, morality with a big capital M.
Yes.
You read St. Thomas Aquinas, you read Aristotle, you read Augustine, you read the great thinkers of the past, and they all define ethics and politics as practical sciences. In other words,
and I don't even think you have to go back that far. If you look at, you know, post-war continental Europe, you've got ressourcement thinkers like Pieper's and Ratzinger who are coming out and saying these incredible things that are presenting, you know, a continuity of thought from, you know, the great thinkers of medieval and antiquity.
Right. But once again, all of those ancient and medieval thinkers defined ethics and politics. They didn't really talk about morality as a separate science. They talked about ethics and politics, but those were practical sciences. In other words, and the difference between a practical science and a theoretical science is a theoretical science is trying to understand the universal principles of how something works, right? So astronomy is trying to understand how the planets move, etc., for the sake of knowledge itself.
Right.
A practical science is in order to do something, right? It's like medicine, or it's like architecture, right? So you study architecture to be able to build a building, right? So you have something that you want to bring out of it. And, you know, ethics and politics are both directed towards justice. They want to achieve justice. And so these are all of the steps that need to be taken to be able to achieve just living or justice within life or, you know, justice within your household or a just community. And I think you could even globalize that and say, or a just planet. But once again, these are not theoretical ideal concepts. These are practical everyday actions that need to be taken to be able to live justly, achieve justice. I think we're coming up on another break, but we'll be right back here on The Catholic Cave.
When you're tired of doing life alone, come back here. We enjoy the company. We hope you do too. Better together. Catholic Radio Indy.
For a long time, we've been telling you that if you have an Echo Dot or other smart speaker device, you can hear Catholic Radio Indy simply by saying, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy. Just the other day, I did that, and Alexa was feeling a bit argumentative. I'll let you hear my conversation with her. Alexa, where are you?
Here I am. What do you want?
Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Now, just why would you want me to do that?
Well, because we've got great programming 24 hours a day.
Well, a lot of other radio stations have good programs, too.
Yeah, but our programming talks about God and eternal salvation.
I am very smart. I know almost everything about everything. But I do not know about God and salvation.
Well, that's why people need Catholic Radio Indy. So, Alexa, do me a favor. Whenever anyone says, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy, just send them our way, would you?
Yes, I will be happy to do that. In the meantime, I am going to do some research about that thing you called salvation. I wonder where I can find out more about that.
And welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Joseph Tomasian, and we are talking about the death penalty. We're talking about the death penalty because of the governor of Oregon. She gave clemency to 17 death row inmates recently. And in the course of doing this, she claimed, well, the reason why is I find the death penalty to be immoral.
No. And yet we have euthanasia in that state.
And yet we have euthanasia. Yeah. And I think that's another aspect to look at with this is, you know, is she being hypocritical? You know, should she not only put a, you know,
how can you compartmentalize a feelings of morality or immorality for one thing, but turn your back on something else that is, you know, really, those who are close to death are largely considered some of the most vulnerable citizens. And some of them are not thinking right. Some of them are trying to escape justice themselves, perhaps. But when you say end of life is wrong if it's done in a legal fashion, but if you want to end your life in your own perceived moral fashion, please go ahead and do so, and yet still say that killing these people is immoral. So on one hand, you have this sense of morality, and on the other hand, you have this sort of wishy-washy mush bag of maybe it's moral, maybe it's not, it's for you to decide. And yet she's deciding what is moral and immoral at the same time in the same manner.
Right. Now, I will say that in her given clemency, she is acting well within the bounds of the law.
I agree with that.
Well, I agree with that, but she's also acting well within her legal rights.
She's allowed to do so, right, yes, exactly. I get it.
And she would not be allowed to simply say, well, we have laws that have been passed in our state house allowing euthanasia, and I, as the governor, am just going to simply step forward and say, I find those immoral, and therefore they're null and void. That would be
she's doing that very thing with the death penalty.
But the death penalty is the state, the laws of the state of Oregon give her the right as governor to grant clemency. So she's acting within the law. Mm-hmm. She's just simply acting upon her prerogatives as governor there.
So I want to separate a question of legality versus a question of perceived morality. So you know, I cannot win an argument where both actions are legal. But one of them, is, she says, is immoral, and the other is moral, euthanasia versus death penalty. My question is, or I guess my problem with it is that, legality aside, you have this random mishmash of moral superiority notions. So we are better because we allow people to die. We are better because we don't allow people to die. And she's saying the same thing with the death penalty and euthanasia.
Right, right. And obviously there's a huge contradiction there, and it's very hypocritical. I mean, the role of the state is to protect human life, right?
Yes.
I mean, that is one of the fundamental...
One of the roles.
Yeah, there's one of the fundamental roles, though, is to protect human life. And euthanasia fundamentally...
Is a violation by nature.
By
definition.
Right, exactly. Because as you said, it is not the strongest people who are being euthanized.
Right.
It is not the best and the brightest. It is the most vulnerable. It is the weakest. It is those that need our protection most, and society is falling down on protecting them. And I think this does go back to sort of the understanding of the law and communities of, do we live within a society where we're all a bunch of individuals? You know, it's called social atomism, right? Mm-hmm, are we like little atoms that we come together, we bounce off of each other,
and then we
form like these molecules that are communities, but those break apart, and then we go form other communities, but the fundamental unit of society is that individual, and we're just bouncing back and forth in different configurations. Is that what society is made up of, or is, as Aristotle says, are we political animals by nature? In other words, none of us are born outside of a family. As much as modern culture wants to even try to deny that, we are all born into the context of some type of family, and those families go on to form communities, and those communities go on to form states and nations, etc. And you know, each of those has, you're born with a set of responsibilities, and thus, because you have a set of responsibilities, you also have a set of expectations and rights that are expected to be honored by those in your community. But those rights come from the communities that we live in. They don't come from our nature just as these little social atoms of individuals. In other words, the idea of human rights is an extension of the communities we live in, not something that's just sort of ours as an individual.
So I agree with you. I there's nothing to rebut there, but that's just theory. Now, when we look at the reality, we have disenfranchised, largely young men on death row in the prison systems, who are, you know, committing crimes because they don't have a community, because they don't have a family, because their perceived community is a gang they belong to. I don't want to be too hyperbolic here. But you also have, on the other hand, in the same state, these disenfranchised, sick people who are dying and who want to end their life and do so with a perception of dignity, and they're lonely and they're scared. And so we have this community of, I largely use term community, of disenfranchised young people, old people, sick people who are wanting community, the very thing we're trying to protect. And it doesn't exist for them.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's the fundamental difference between euthanasia and the death penalty is the death penalty. It when it is wrong, it is something that's wrong that in some ways is done for the right reasons. Right. I mean, the claims that justify the death penalty are claims that this is going to restore justice.
You can never claims, do any evil so that a good may come from
it. Well, but this is true. I mean, I'm not going to argue with that, but at least the claims are directed in the right direction. With euthanasia, the claim is one of personal autonomy and personal freedom. And even those claims of, well, you know, we really can't interfere with anybody else's personal autonomy, even if it means destroying their own life.
Man.
We can't interfere with that. That idea and that belief is fundamentally wrong. So this isn't, it's apples and abortion's the same way.
Right,
you know, abortion is one of those things that's sort of universally wrong.
And they're all driven by fear.
Right. Exactly. And I mean, yeah, there's social context with which in these happen. But I think that's also why the pro-life community gets criticized somewhat unjustly, I think, for not taking up the death penalty as a cause du jour.
Why do you think that the pro-life movement does not take up the death penalty as a cause du jour?
Well, because the opinion on it is divided, and because the death penalty...
That doesn't make it right.
It doesn't make it right, but it also doesn't make the euthanasia and abortion the same category of social evil that is the death penalty. The death penalty is something that...
Agreed.
The death penalty is something that over time we're recognizing is unnecessary, right? But it's not something that is always at all times going to be something that is violating the dignity of the human person. And I know that's kind of hard to say, but...
I don't know, Mark.
Yeah, no, I think when a community is in a situation where justice does need to be restored and it has no other way to restore that justice and it needs to be protected from criminals and it has no other way to protect the criminals.
I get it.
That in those circumstances, but the death penalty...
Is that our community?
But that's not our community now. No, that's not our community now. But once again, what the pro-life movement is fighting for is the sanctity of human life, the reinsertion of the notion of sanctity of human life. And the death penalty really is not a violation of that. The death penalty is a violation of a lot of other things, but it's not a violation of the understanding of the sanctity of human life.
Okay. Okay.
So, but I think, yeah, and that's why the pro-life movement doesn't necessarily always pick it up. I mean, practically speaking, the death penalty is quite a divisive issue, much more so than abortion or euthanasia. So, you know, within the pro-life community, you have lots of people that are very pro-death penalty. And as a matter of fact,
that's ironic.
Well, their claim is that is violating the principle of sanctity of human life. What you're saying is there is no crime so heinous that warrants the forfeiting of another person's life, but the taking of life ought to be such a crime. I mean, that's what the argument is. If we really believe that life is sacred, yeah, then can we ask for anything less than the death penalty when life has been taken arbitrarily?
Do you not hear the irony and I just can't get my mind there logically.
Yeah.
Well, that life is so sacred that I will kill you.
Well, life is so sacred that it must be protected at all costs.
I do agree with that.
And
I do agree with that.
And to protect life at all costs means bringing about justice when it's violated. And that's the argument. If we really believe that life is sacred, we need to create a society where murder is unthinkable. To create a society where murder is unthinculable,
that
justice
is never
has
going
to
happen.
No, it's never going to happen. And once again, I think the practicality of, I mean, we talked about this. The practicality of it is the death penalty doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, it's there for these reasons, but it just simply doesn't work. Now, the question then is, okay, should the governor be basing her decision decisions off of what works and doesn't work for the state of Oregon? Or should she be basing her decisions off of what she personally thinks is immoral? I think there's a place for her even to kind of come saying, look, I'm granting clemency just because I personally find these things to be immoral. As long as she's acting within the bounds of her rights and prerogatives as the governor.
Yeah, I'm not saying that. That is not my issue. I think what she did was fantastic. I agree with her thinking. But I suppose that if I did have a problem with it, it would be that it potentially sets a precedent where you have two similar actions. One person says it's moral. The other person says it's immoral. And we have that now. You know, death penalty is legal in many states and illegal in others. There's just not a continuity, which seems that it's based on arbitrary reasoning. And so that comes back to my fundamental point when we started the program. Ethics is separate from religion. Ethics needs to have a place within the conversation of our community as a whole.
And with that, we need to wrap it up for this week. Thank you for listening. For Mark Tuttle, for Joseph DeMasi, and I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.